Chapter 11. The exchange of greetings between Selma and the quartet had seemed a little cramped for old friends, but that might have been expected. After all, she was aiding and abetting a program that might lead to one of them getting charged with murder, and they had been invited by her to the office of a well-known private detective. When they had got seated, she sent her eyes to Wolfe and kept them there. Their eyes were more interested in her than in Wolfe. I concentrated on them. Selma's descriptions of Tom and Jerry had been adequate and accurate. Jerome Markoff was big and broad, taller than me, and so solemn it must have hurt. But it could have been the ulcers that hurt. Tom Irwin, with his dark skin and thin little clipped mustache, looked more like a saxophone artist than a printing executive, even while holding his wife's hand. His wife Fanny was obviously not at her best, with her face giving the impression that she was trying not to give in to a raging headache. But even so, she was no eyesore. Under favorable conditions, she would have been very decorative. She was a blonde, and a headache is much harder on a blonde than on a brunette. Some brunettes are actually improved by a mild one. This brunette, Rita Arkoff, didn't need one. There was a faint touch of snake hips in her walk, a faint suggestion of slant at the corners of her eyes, and a faint hint of a pout in the set of her well-tinted lips. But an order giver. Wolfe's eyes went from the Arkoffs on his left to the Irwins on his right. "I don't presume," he said, "to thank you for coming, since it was at Mrs. Malloy's request. She has told you what I'm after. Mr. Albert Fryer, counsel for Peter Hayes, wishes to establish a basis for a retrial or an appeal, and I'm trying to help him. I assume you are all in sympathy with that." They exchanged glances. "Sure we are," Jerome Markoff declared, "if you can find one. Is there any chance?" "I think so." Wolfe was easy and relaxed. "Certain aspects have not been thoroughly investigated, not by the police because of the overwhelming evidence against Peter Hayes, and not by Mr. Fryer because he lacked funds and facilities. They deserve—" "Does he have funds now?" Tom Irwin asked. His voice didn't fit his physique. You would have expected a squeak, but it was a deep baritone. "No. My interest has been engaged, no matter how, and I am indulging it. Those aspects deserve inquiry, and last evening I sent a man to look into one of them, a man named Johnny Keams, who worked for me intermittently. He was to learn if there was any possibility that on the evening the murder was committed, January 3rd, the invitation to Mrs. Malloy to join a theater party had been designed with the purpose of getting her out of the way. Of course it didn't." "You sent that man?" Arkoff demanded. His wife looked reproachfully at her friend. "Selma, darling, really, you know perfectly well—" "If you please," Wolfe showed her a palm and his tone sharpened. "Save your resentment for a need. I'm imputing no malignity to any of you. I was about to say it didn't have to be designed, since the murderer may have merely seized an opportunity. And if it was designed, it didn't have to be one of you who designed it. You might have been quite unaware of it. That was what I sent Mr. Keams to find out. And he was to begin by seeing you, all four of you. First on his list was Mrs. Arkoff, since she had phoned the invitation to Mrs. Malloy." His eyes leveled at Rita. "Did he see you, madam?" She started to answer, but her husband cut in. "Hold it, Rita." Apparently he could give orders, too. He looked at Wolfe. "What's the big idea? If you sent him, why don't you ask him? Why drag us down here? Did someone else send him?" Wolfe nodded. He closed his eyes for a moment and opened them and nodded again. "A logical inference, Mr. Arkoff, but wrong. I sent him, but I can't ask him because he's dead. On Riverside Drive in the 90s, shortly before midnight last night, an automobile hit him and killed him. It's possible that it was an accident, but I don't think so. I think he was murdered. I think that working on the assignment I had given him, he had uncovered something that was a mortal threat to someone. Therefore, I must see the people he saw and find out what was said. Did he see you, Mrs. Arkoff? Her husband stopped her again. This is different, he told Wolf, and he looked and sounded different. If he was murdered, what makes you think it wasn't an accident? Wolf shook his head. We won't go into that, Mr. Arkoff, and we don't have to, because the police also suspect that it wasn't. A sergeant at the Homicide Bureau phoned me today to ask if Mr. Keams was working for me last night, and if so, what his assignment was and whom he had seen. Mr. Goodwin put him off. He phoned again later, I put in. Yes, what did you tell him? That we were trying to check and would let him know as soon as we had anything useful. Wolf went back to them. I wanted to talk with you people myself first. I wanted to learn what you had told Mr. Keams and whether he had uncovered anything that might have threatened one of you or someone else. I'll have... Fanny Irwin blurted. He didn't uncover anything with me. She had got her hand back from her husband's hold. Then that's what I'll learn, madam. I'll have to tell the police what he was to do and whom he was to see. That can't be postponed much longer. But it may make things easier for you if I can also tell them that I have talked with you, depending, of course, on what you tell me. Or would you prefer to save it for the police? My God, Tom Irwin groaned. This is a nice mess. And we can thank you for it, Arkoff told Wolf. Sicking your damn snoop on us. His head turned. And you, Selma, you started it. Let Selma alone, Rita ordered him. She's had a rough time, and you can't blame her. She looked at Wolf, and she wasn't pouting. Let's go ahead and get it over with. Yes, your man saw me at my apartment. He came when I was about ready to leave to meet my husband for dinner. He said he was investigating the possibility of a new trial for Peter Hayes. I thought he was after Selma's alibi, and I told him he might as well save his breath because she was with me every minute, but it was the invitation he wanted to ask about. He asked when I first thought of asking Selma, and I said at the restaurant when Tom phoned and told me Fanny couldn't make it. He asked why I asked Selma instead of someone else, and I said because I liked her and enjoyed her company, and also because when Tom phoned, I asked him if he wanted to suggest anyone, and he suggested Selma. He asked if Tom gave any special reason for having Selma, and I said he didn't have to because I wanted her anyway. He was going to ask more, but I was late, and I said that was all I knew anyhow. So that was all. No, he asked when he could see my husband, and I told him we'd be home around 10 o'clock and he might see him then.
Did he?
Yes, we got home a little after 10, and he was waiting down in the lobby. Wolf's eyes moved.
Mr. Arkoff?
Jerry hesitated, then shrugged. I talked with him there in the lobby. I didn't take him upstairs because I had some scripts to go over. He asked me the same things he had asked my wife, but I couldn't tell him as much as she had because she had talked with Tom on the phone. I really couldn't tell him anything. He tried to be clever, asking trick questions about how it was decided to invite Mrs. Malloy, and finally I got fed up and told him to go peddle his papers.
Did he say anything about having seen Mr. or Mrs. Irwin?
No, I don't think so. No.
Then he left?
I suppose so. We left him in the lobby when we went to the elevator.
You and your wife went up to your apartment?
Yes.
What did you do the rest of the evening?
Arkoff took a breath.
"By God," he said, "if anyone had told me an hour ago that I was going to be asked where I was at the time of the murder, I would have thought he was crazy."
"No doubt. It does often seem an impertinence. Where were you?"
"I was in my apartment working with scripts until after midnight. My wife was in another room, and neither of us could have gone out without the other one knowing it. No one else was there."
"That seems conclusive. Certainly, either conclusive or collusive."
Wolfe's eyes went right.
"Mr. Irwin, since Mr. Keams had been told that you had suggested Mrs. Malloy, I presume he sought you. Did he find you?"
From the expression on Tom Irwin's face, he needed a hand to hold. He opened his mouth and closed it again.
"I'm not sure I like this," he said. "If I'm going to be questioned about a murder, I think I'd rather be questioned by the police."
"Oh, for heaven's sake," his wife protested. "He won't bite you. Do what Rita did. Get it over with." She went to Wolfe. "Do you want me to tell it?"
"If you were present, madam."
"I was. That man, what was his name?"
"John Joseph Keams."
"It was nearly 9 o'clock when he came, and we were just going out. We had promised to drop in at a party some friends were giving for somebody, and we would have been gone if my maid hadn't had to fix the lining of my wrap. He said the same thing he told Rita about the possibility of a new trial for Peter Hayes, and he asked my husband about the phone call to the restaurant. Rita has told you about that. Actually..."
"Did your husband's account of it agree with Mrs. Arkoff's?"
"Of course. Why wouldn't it? Actually, though, it was I who suggested asking Selma Malloy. While Tom was at the phone, I told him to tell her to ask Selma because I could trust him with her. It was partly a joke, but I'm one of those jealous wives. Then he wanted to ask some more questions. I mean that man Keams. But by that time my rap was ready and we had told him all we knew. That was all there was to it."
"Well, did your husband tell him that you had suggested asking Mrs. Malloy?"
"Yes, I'm pretty sure. Didn't you, Tom?"
"Yes." "And you went to the party. How late did you stay?"
"Not late at all. It was a bore, and my husband was tired. We got home around 11 and went to bed. We sleep in the same room."
Wolfe started to make a face, realized he was doing it, and called it off. The idea of sleeping in the same room with anybody on earth, man or woman, was too much. "Then," he asked, "you had only that one brief talk with Mr. Keams? You didn't see him again?"
"No, how could we?"
"Did you see him again, Mr. Irwin?"
"No."
"Can you add anything to your wife's account of your talk with him?"
"No, that was all there was to it. I might add that our maid sleeps in, and she was there that night."
"Thank you. That should be helpful. I'll include it in my report to the police."
Wolfe went back to the wife. "One little point, Mrs. Irwin. If you decided earlier in the day that you wouldn't be able to go to the theatre that evening, you might have mentioned it to someone, for instance, to some friend on the phone. And you might also have mentioned, partly as a joke, that you would suggest that Mrs. Malloy be asked in your place."
"Did anything like that happen?"
She shook her head. "No, it couldn't have, because I didn't decide not to go until just before my husband came home."
"Then your headache was a sudden attack?"
"I don't know what you would call sudden. I was lying down with it most of the afternoon and taking Emigrin, and I was hoping it would go away. But I had to give up."
"Do you have frequent headaches?"
Irwin burst out,
"What the hell has that got to do with it?"
"Probably nothing," Wolfe conceded. "I'm fishing whitewater, Mr. Irwin, and am casting at random."
"It seems to me," Arkoff put in, "that you're fishing in dead water. Asking Mrs. Malloy didn't have to be designed at all. If Peter Hayes didn't kill Malloy, if someone else did, of course it was somebody who knew him.
He could have phoned Malloy and said he wanted to see him alone, and Malloy told him to come to the apartment. They would be alone there because Mrs. Malloy had gone to the theater. Why couldn't it have happened like that?
It could, Wolfe agreed. Quite possible. The invitation to Mrs. Malloy was merely one of the aspects that deserved inquiry, and it might have been quickly eliminated. But not now. Now there is a question that must be answered. Who killed Johnny Keams, and why?
Some damn fool, some hit-and-run maniac.
Possibly, but I don't believe it. I must be satisfied now, and so must the police. And even if you people are innocent of any complicity, you can't escape harassment. I'll want to know more than I do now about the evening of January 3rd, about what happened at the theater. I understand.
Yes, Archie?
Before you leave last night, I said, I have a question to ask them.
Go ahead.
I leaned forward to have all their faces as they turned to me. About Johnny Keams, I said, did he ask any of you anything about Bill Lesser? They had never heard the name before. You can't always go by the reaction to a sudden, unexpected question, since some people are extremely good at handling their faces. But if that name meant anything to one or more of them, they were better than good. They all looked blank and wanted to know who Bill Lesser was. Of course, Wolfe would also have liked to know who he was, but didn't say so. I told him that was all, and he resumed. I understand that Mrs. Malloy and Mrs. Arkoff went into their seats before curtain time, and that Mr. Arkoff and Mr. Irwin joined them about an hour later, saying they had been in a bar across the street. Is that correct, Mr. Arkoff? Arkoff didn't care for that at all, and neither did Irwin. Their position was that their movements on the evening of January 3rd had no significance unless it was assumed that one or both of them might have killed Malloy and framed Peter Hayes, and that was absurd. Wolfe's position was that the police would ask him if he had questioned them about January 3rd, and if he said he had and they had balked, the police would want to know why. Rita told her husband to quit arguing and get it over with. And that only made it worse until she snapped at him, "What's so touchy about it? Weren't you just dosing up?" He gave her a dirty look and then transferred it to Wolfe. "My wife and I," he said, "met Mrs. Malloy in the theater lobby at 8:30. The ladies went on in and I waited in the lobby for Irwin. He came a few minutes later and said he wanted a drink. And he also said he didn't care much for plays about Joan of Arc. We went across the street and had a couple of drinks, and by the time we got into our seats, the first act was about over."
Wolfe's head turned. "You corroborate that, Mr. Irwin?"
"I do."
Wolfe turned a hand over. "So simple, gentlemen. Why all the pother? And with a new and quite persuasive detail that Mr. Irwin doesn't care for plays about Joan of Arc. An inspired hoyden. To show you to what lengths an investigation can be carried, and sometimes has to be, a dozen men could make a tour of Mr. Irwin's friends and acquaintances and ask if they have ever heard him express an attitude toward Joan of Arc and plays about her. I doubt if I'll be driven to that extremity. Have you any questions?" They hadn't, for him. Rita Arkoff got up and went to Selma, and Fanny Irwin joined them. The men did, too, for a moment, and then headed for the hall, and I followed them. They got their coats on and stood and waited, and finally their women came, and I opened the door. As they moved out, Rita was telling the men that she had asked Selma to come and eat with them, but she had said she wasn't up to it. "And no wonder," Rita was saying as I swung the door to. When I re-entered the office, Selma didn't look as if she were up to anything whatever, sitting with her shoulders slumped and her head sagging and her eyes closed. Wolfe was speaking, inviting her to stay for not only dinner but also the night. He said he wanted her at hand for consultation if occasion arose, but that wasn't it. She had brought word from Parker that the court formalities might be completed in the morning, and if so, we might get to the safe deposit box by noon. For that, Mrs. Malloy would be needed,
and Wolf would never trust a woman to be where she was supposed to be when you wanted her. Therefore, he was telling her how pleasant our south room was, directly under his, with a good bed and morning sunshine. But no sail, not even for dinner. She got to her feet, and I went to the hall with her.
"It's hopeless, isn't it?" she said. Not a question.
I patted her shoulder professionally and told her we had barely started. In the office again, Wolf demanded, "Who is Bill Lesser?" I told him, reporting it verbatim, including my phone call to Delia Brandt, and explaining I had hoped to get a glimmer from one or more of the quartet at sound of the name. He wasn't very enthusiastic, but admitted it was worth a look and said we would put Fred Durkin on it. I asked if I should phone Pearly Stebbins, and he said no, it was too close to dinner time, and he wanted first to think over his talk with Mrs. Malloy's friends. He heaved a sigh.
"Confound it," he complained, "no gleam anywhere. No little fact that stings, no word that trips. I have no appetite."
I snorted. "That's the least of my worries," I declared. Chapter 12. I never did phone Pearly because I didn't have to. Fred Durkin called during dinner and said he had had no better luck at the theater and the bar than at the phone booth places. And I told him to come in, and he was there by the time we returned to the office with coffee. He had drawn nothing but blanks, and I was glad we had a bone for him with a little meat on it. He was to do a take on William Lesser, address, occupation, and the trimmings, and specifically, had he been loose at 11:48 Wednesday night. That last seemed a waste of time and energy, since I had it entered that the Arkoffs and Irwins had never heard of him. But Wolf wanted a little fact that stung, and you can never tell. Just before Fred left, Ori Cather came. Ori brought a little package of items he had selected from the cartons in the Malloy apartment. And if they were the cream, the milk must have been dishwater. He opened the package on my desk, and we went through the treasure together, while Wolf sat and read a book. There was a desk calendar with an entry on the leaf for January 2nd. Call B. And nothing else. A batch of South American travel folders. Half a dozen books of matches from restaurants. A stack of carbon copies of letters, of which the most exciting was one to the Pearson Appliance Corporation, telling them what he thought of their electric shaver. And more of the same. "I don't believe it," I told Ori. "You must have brought the wrong package." "Honest to God," he swore, "talk about dreck. I never saw anything to equal it." "Not even check stubs?" "Not a stub." I turned to Wolf. Mike Malloy was one of a kind. Meeting sudden death by violence in the prime of his manhood, as you would put it, he left in his office not a single item that would interest a crow, let alone a detective. Not even the phone number of his barber. No gleam anywhere.
"I wouldn't put it that way, not prime of manhood."
"Okay, but unless he expected to get killed..." The doorbell rang. I stepped to the door to the hall, switched on the stoop light, took a look, and turned. Kramer, alone.
"Ah."
Wolf lifted his eyes from the book.
"In the front room, Ori, if you please. Take that stuff with you. When Mr. Kramer has passed through, you might as well leave and report in the morning."
I stood a moment until Ori had gathered up the treasure and started for the door to the front room, and then went to the hall and opened up. Many a time, seeing the burly breadth and round red face of Inspector Kramer of Homicide there on the stoop, I had left the chain bolt on and spoken with him through the crack. But I now swung the door wide. "Good evening," I said courteously.
"Hello, Goodwin. Wolf in?"
That was a form of wit. He knew damn well Wolf was in, since he was never out. If I had been feeling sociable, I would have reciprocated by telling him no, Wolf had gone skating at Rockefeller Center. But the haul Ori had brought had been hard on my sense of humor, so I merely admitted him and took his coat. He didn't wait for escort to the office.
By the time I got there, he was already in the red leather chair, and he and Wolf were glaring at each other. They do that from force of habit. Which way they go from the glare, toward a friendly exchange of information, or toward a savage exchange of insults, depends on the circumstances. That time Kramer's opening pass was mild enough. He merely remarked that Goodwin had told Sergeant Stebbins he would call him back and hadn't done so. Wolf grunted and merely remarked that he didn't suppose Kramer had come in person for information which Mr. Goodwin could have given Mr. Stebbins on the phone.
"But he didn't," Kramer growled back.
"He will now," Wolf growled back. "Do you want him to?"
"No."
Kramer got more comfortable.
"I'm here now. There's more to it than Johnny Keams, but I'll take that first. What was he doing for you last night?"
"He was investigating a certain aspect of the murder of Michael M. Malloy on January 3rd.
"The hell he was. I thought a murder investigation was finished when the murderer was tried and convicted."
Wolf nodded.
"It is. But not when an innocent man is tried and convicted."
It looked very much as if they were headed for insults. But before Kramer had one ready, Wolf went on.
"You would ask, of course, if I have evidence to establish Peter Hayes's innocence. No, I haven't. My reasons for thinking him innocent would not be admissible as evidence and would have no weight for you. I intend to find the evidence if it exists, and Johnny Keams was looking for it last night."
Kramer's sharp eyes, surrounded by crinkles, were leveled at Wolf's brown ones. He was not amused. On previous occasions during a murder investigation, he had found Wolf a thorn in his hide and a pain in his neck. But this was the first time it had ever happened after it had been wrapped up by a jury.
"I am familiar," he said, "with the evidence that convicted Hayes. I collected it, or my men did." "Phooey. It didn't have to be collected. It was there."
"Well, we picked it up. What aspect was Keams working on?"
"The invitation to Mrs. Malloy to go to the theater, on the chance that it was designed to get her away from the apartment. His instructions were to see Mr. and Mrs. Arkoff and Mr. and Mrs. Irwin, and to report to me if he got any hint of suspicion. He didn't report, which was typical of him, and he paid for his disdain. However, I know that he saw those four, all of them. They were here this afternoon for more than an hour. He saw Mrs. Arkoff at her apartment shortly after 8 o'clock, and returned 2 hours later and saw her and her husband. In between those two visits, he saw Mr. and Mrs. Irwin at their apartment. Do you want to know what they said they told him?"
Kramer said he did, and Wolf obliged. He gave him a full and fair report, including all essentials, unless you count as an essential his telling them that he wanted to talk with them before he told the police what Johnny Keams had been doing. And anyway, Kramer could guess that for himself. At the end, he added a comment.
"The inference is patent. Either one or more of them were lying, or Johnny saw someone besides them, or his death had no connection with his evening's work. I will accept the last only when I must, and apparently you will too, or you wouldn't be here. Did the circumstances eliminate fortuity?"
"If you mean could it have been an accident, it's barely possible. It wasn't on the drive proper, it was on one of those narrow side approaches to apartment houses. A man and woman were in a parked car 100 feet away waiting for someone. The car was going slow when it passed them, going up the lane. They saw Keams step into the lane from between two parked cars, and they think the driver of the car blinked his lights, but they're not sure. As the car approached Keams, it slowed nearly to a stop, and then it took a sudden spurt and swerved straight at Keams, and that was it. It kept going and had turned a corner before the man and woman were out of their car. You know we found the car this morning parked on Upper Broadway, and it was stolen?"
"Yes."
"So it doesn't look like fortuity. I must remember to use that in a report.
You said it could be that one of them was lying, or more than one. What do you think?
Wolf puckered his lips.
It's hard to say. It can't very well be just one of them, since their alibis are all in pairs. The two men in the bar the evening of January 3rd, and for last night, man and wife at home together in both cases. Of course you know their addresses, since you collected the evidence against Peter Hayes. They're in the file.
Kramer's eyes came to me.
In the neighborhood, Goodwin?
Near enough, I told him. The Arkoffs in the 80s on Central Park West, and the Irwins in the 90s on West End Avenue.
Not that that's important. You understand, Wolf, as far as I'm concerned, the Hayes case is closed. He's guilty as hell. You admit you have no evidence. It's Keams I'm interested in. If it was homicide, homicide is my business. That's what I'm after.
Wolf's brows went up.
Do you want a suggestion? I can always use a suggestion.
Drop it.
Charge Johnny Keams's death to accident and close the file. I suppose a routine search for the hit-and-run driver must be made, but confine it to that. Otherwise, you'll find that the Hayes case is open again, and that would be embarrassing. For all I know, you may have already been faced with that difficulty, and that's why you're here. For instance, through something found in Johnny Keams's pockets. Was there something?
No.
Wolf's eyes were narrowed at him.
I am being completely candid with you, Mr. Kramer.
So am I. Nothing was found on Keams but the usual items. Keys, cigarettes, driving license, handkerchief, a little cash, pen and pencil. After what you tell me, I'm surprised he didn't have a memo of those people's names and addresses. Didn't you give him one, Goodwin?
No, Johnny didn't believe in memos. He didn't even carry a notebook. He thought his memory was as good as mine, but it wasn't. Now it's no good at all.
He went back to Wolf. About your being completely candid, I didn't think I'd go into this, but I will. Tuesday's papers had an ad headed to PH and signed by you. Tuesday noon, Sergeant Stebbins phoned to ask Goodwin about it, and Goodwin told him to ask Lieutenant Murphy of the Missing Persons Bureau. What he learned from Murphy satisfied him, and me too, that your ad hadn't been directed at Peter Hayes, but at a man named Paul Harold, and we crossed it off as coincidence. But Wednesday morning, yesterday, Goodwin goes to the city prison and has a talk with Peter Hayes. News of that gets to Murphy, and he sees Hayes and asks him if he is Paul Harold, and Hayes says no. But here you are, saying you think Hayes is innocent and up to your neck in it, hell for breakfast. If you had Keams investigating one aspect, how many men have you got on other aspects? You don't toss money around just to see it flutter in the breeze. So if you're being so goddamn candid, who's your client?
Wolf nodded.
That would interest you, naturally. I'm sorry, Mr. Kramer, I can't tell you. You can ask Mr. Albert Fryer, counsel for Peter Hayes, and see if you have better luck.
Nuts.
Is Peter Hayes Paul Harold?
He told Mr. Goodwin he is not.
You say he told Lieutenant Murphy he is not.
He should know.
Then why are you on the warpath?
Because both my curiosity and cupidity have been aroused, and together they are potent.
Believe me, Mr. Kramer, I have been candid to the limit of my discretion.
Will you have some beer?
No, I'm going. I have to start somebody on these Arkoffs and Irwins.
Then the Hayes case is open again. That is not a jibe, merely a fact.
Can you spare me another minute? I would like to know exactly what was found in Johnny Keams's pockets.
I've told you. Kramer got up. The usual items.
Yes, but I'd like a complete list.
I would appreciate it if you will indulge me.
Kramer eyed him. He could never make up his mind whether Wolf was really after something or was merely putting on an act. Thinking he might find out, he turned to me.
Get my office, Goodwin.
I swiveled and dialed, and when I had the number, Kramer came to my desk and took it.
I was supposing he would tell someone to get the list from the file and read it off to me, but no, sir. That way I could have faked something, and who would trust Goodwin? He stayed at the phone, and when the list had been dug out and was called off to him, he relayed it to me, item by item, and I wrote it down, as follows. Motor operator's license, Social Security card, Eastern Insurance Company identification card, 2 tickets to baseball game for May 11th, 3 letters in envelopes, personal matters, newspaper clipping about fluorine in drinking water, $22.16 in bills and coins, pack of cigarettes, 2 books of matches, 4 keys on a ring, 1 handkerchief, ballpoint pen, pencil, pocket knife. I started to hand it to Wolf, but Kramer reached and grabbed it. When he had finished studying it, he returned it to me, and I passed it to Wolf, and Kramer asked him, "Well?"
"Thank you very much."
Wolf sounded as if he meant it.
"One question. Is it possible that something, some small article, was taken from his clothing before this list was made?"
"Possible, yes. Not very likely."
"The man and woman who saw it from the parked car are respectable and responsible citizens. The man went to where the body was lying, and the woman blew the horn, and an officer came in a couple of minutes. The officer was the first one to touch the body. Why, what's missing?"
"Money. Archie, how much did you give Johnny for expenses?"
$100.
"And presumably he had a little of his own."
"Of course, Mr. Kramer, I am not ass enough to suggest that you have a thief on your force, but that $100 belonged to me, since Johnny Keams had possession of it as my agent. If by any chance it should turn up..." "God damn you, I ought to knock you through that wall," Kramer said through his teeth, and whirled and tramped out. I waited until I heard the front door slam, then went to the hall and on to the one-way glass panel to see him cross the sidewalk and climb into his car. When I returned to the office, Wolf was sitting with his fingers interlaced at the apex of his central mound, trying not to look smug. I stood and looked down at him. "I'll be damned," I said, "so you've got your little fact that stings. Next, who did he grease with it?"
He nodded. "Not too difficult, I should think. Apparently you share my assumption that he bribed somebody."
"No question about it. Johnny wasn't perfect, but he came close to it about money. That $100 was yours, and for him that was that." I sat down. "I'm glad to hear that it won't be difficult to find out who got it. I was afraid it might be."
"I think not. At least not to reach an assumption worth testing. Let us suppose it was you instead of Johnny. Having seen Mrs. Arkoff, you arrive at the Irwins' apartment and find them about ready to leave, being detained by a necessary repair to Mrs. Irwin's garment, which is being made by the maid. Mostly, they merely confirm what Mrs. Arkoff has already told you, but contribute one new detail: that the suggestion to invite Mrs. Molloy came originally from Mrs. Irwin. That is interesting, even provocative. And you want to pursue it, and try to. But by then the maid has the garment repaired, and Mrs. Irwin puts it on, and they leave. You leave with them, of course, going down in the elevator with them, and they go off. There you are. You have seen 3 of them, and have only 1 more on your list. It's a little after 9 o'clock, and there is an hour to pass before you can see Mr. Arkoff. What do you do?"
"Nothing to it. As soon as the Irwins are out of sight, I go back upstairs and see the maid."
"Would Johnny?"
"Absolutely."
"Then he did. Worth testing, surely."
"Yeah, it stings, all right. If that maid took your $100, she'll take more." I looked at my wrist. 10 minutes to 11. Shall I give her a whirl now?"
"I think not. Mr. and Mrs. Irwin might be there."
"I can phone and find out."
"Do so."
I got the number from the book and dialed it, and after four whirs a female voice told me hello. I sent my voice through my nose.
May I speak to Mrs. Irwin, please?
This is Mrs. Irwin. Who is this? I cradled it gently, not to be rude, and turned. Mrs. Irwin answered, I guess it will have to wait until morning. I'll call Mrs. Malloy first and get the maid's name. She probably knows it. Wolf nodded.
It will be ticklish, and it must not be botched.
Right, I'll bring her here and take her to the basement and hold matches to her toes. I have a remark. You're asking Kramer for a list of the contents of Johnny's pockets. That was only par for a genius. But you're bumping him off the trail by pretending you wanted your money back. I couldn't have done it better myself. Satisfactory. I hope I'm not flattering you.
Not likely, he grumbled, and picked up his book.
Chapter 13. The maid's name was Ella Reyes. I got that from Selma Malloy on the phone at 8 o'clock Friday morning, and also that she was around 30 years old, small and neat, the color of coffee with cream, and had been with the Irwins for about a year. But I didn't get to tackle her. Relieving Fritz of the chore of taking Wolf's breakfast tray up to his room, where, a mountain of yellow silk pajamas, he stood barefoot in the flood of sunshine near a window, I learned that he had shifted the lineup. Ori Cather was to call on the man and woman who, sitting in a parked car, had seen the end of Johnny Keams. Their name and address was in the papers, as well as the fact that they agreed that the driver of the hit-and-run car had been a man, and that was about all. They had, of course, been questioned by old hands at it, but Wolf wanted Ori to get it direct. Saul Panzer was to take the maid, write his own opening, and ad lib it from there. He was to be equipped with $500 from the safe, which, added to the C he already had, would make 600. A rosy prospect for Ella Reyes, since it would be tax-free. I was to be on call for the ceremony of opening the safe deposit box, if and when it was scheduled. Wolf was good enough to supply a reason for giving Saul the maid and me the ceremony. He said that if difficulties arose, Mrs. Malloy would be more tractable with me present. Wit. I was fiddling around the office when Wolf came down from the plant rooms at 11 o'clock. Saul had arrived at 9 and got a thorough briefing and 5 C's, and departed, and Ori had come and gone to see the eyewitnesses. Parker phoned a little after 10, said he would probably get the court order before noon, and told me to stand by. I asked if I should alert Mrs. Malloy, and he said she wouldn't be needed, so I phoned her that she could relax. Feeling that the situation called for a really cutting remark to the wit, I concocted a few, but none of them were sharp enough, so when he entered and crossed to his desk, I merely said, "Mrs. Malloy isn't coming to the party. You have bewitched her. She admits she wouldn't stay last night because she was afraid to trust herself so close to you. She never wants to go anywhere anymore unless you were there." He grunted and picked up a catalogue that had come in the morning mail, and the phone rang. It was Parker. I was to meet him and Patrick Deegan at the Metropolitan Safe Deposit Company at noon. When I got there on Madison Avenue in the 40s, 5 minutes early, I discovered that I hadn't exaggerated when I called it a party, and nobody was late. There were 10 of us gathered down in the anteroom of the vaults: Parker, Deegan, 2 officers of the Safe Deposit Company, an attendant of the same, an assistant district attorney with a city dick known to me, apparently as his bodyguard, a fingerprint scientist from the police laboratory, also known to me, a stranger in rimless cheaters whose identity I learned later, and me. Evidently, opening a safe deposit box outside of routine can be quite an affair. I wondered where the mayor was. After the 2 MSDC officers had thoroughly studied a document Parker had handed them, we were all escorted through the steel barrier and into a room, not any too big, with 3 chairs and a narrow table in its center.
One of the MSDC officers went out and in a couple of minutes came back, carrying a metal box about 24 by 8 by 6. Not normally, but with his fingertips hooked under the bottom edges at front and back. Before an appreciative audience, he put it down, tenderly, on the table. And the fingerprint man took the stage, putting his case also on the table and opening it. I wouldn't say that he stretched it purposely, playing to the gallery, but he sure did an all-out job. He was at it a good half hour, covering top, sides, ends, and bottom, with dusters, brushes, flippers, magnifying glasses, camera, and print records which came from a briefcase carried by the assistant DA. They should have furnished more chairs. He handled his climax fine, putting all his paraphernalia back in his case and shutting it before he told us, "I identify 6 separate prints on the box as the same as those on the records marked Michael M. Malloy. 5 other prints are probably the same, but I wouldn't certify them. Some other prints, maybe." Nobody applauded. Someone sighed, tired of standing up. Parker addressed the stranger with the rimless cheaters. "That meets the provisions of the order, doesn't it?" "Yes," the stranger conceded, "but I think the expert should certify it in writing." That started an argument. The expert was allergic to writing. He would maintain his conclusion orally, without reservation, before 9 witnesses. But he wouldn't sign a statement until he had made a prolonged study in the laboratory of his photographs and Malloy's recorded prints, and had his findings verified by a colleague. That wasn't very logical, but they couldn't budge him. Finally, the stranger said he would stand by his concession that the oral conclusion satisfied the order, and told the MSDC officer to give Parker the box and the key. The duplicate key, which had been provided by the MSDC to open the compartment the box had been in. Parker said no, give them to Mr. Deegan. But before Deegan got them, he had to sign a receipt for them. "All right, open it," the assistant DA told him. Deegan stood with a hand resting on the box and sent his quick brown eyes around the arc. "Not in public," he said, politely but firmly. "This was Mr. Malloy's box, and I represent his estate by a court order. If you will leave, please, or if you prefer, I'll take it to another room." Another argument, a free-for-all. They wanted to see the box opened, but in the end had to give up, when the assistant DA reluctantly agreed with Parker that Deegan's position was legally sound. He left the room with his bodyguard, and the fingerprint scientist followed them. The 2 MSDC officers didn't like it at all, but with the law gone, they had no choice, so out they went. Deegan looked at the stranger in rimless cheaters and demanded, "Well, sir?" "I stay," the stranger declared. "I represent the New York State Tax Commission." He was close enough to the table to reach the box by stretching an arm. "Death and taxes," Parker told Deegan, "the laws of nature and the laws of man. You can't budge him. Close the door, Archie." "Behind you," Deegan said. He was looking at Parker. "As you go out." Parker smiled at him. "Oh, come, Mr. Goodwin and I are not the public. We have a status and a legitimate interest. It was through us that you got that box." "I know it." Deegan kept his hand on it. "But I am now legally in charge of Malloy's estate, temporarily at least, and my only proper obligation is to the estate. You're a lawyer, Mr. Parker, you know that. Be reasonable. What do I actually know about what Nero Wolfe is after, or what you're after? Only what you've told me. I don't say that I think you already know about something that's in this box, and that I'm afraid Goodwin will grab it and run. But I do say that it's my responsibility to run no risk of any kind in guarding the estate. And the fact that I got the responsibility through you has nothing to do with it. Isn't that reasonable?" It was an appeal. "Yes," Parker said, "it's eminently reasonable. I can't challenge it, and I don't. But we are not going to leave.
We are not going to grab anything or even touch anything unless invited, but we are going to see what you find in that box. If you summon help and demand that we be put out, I doubt if you'll be obeyed under the circumstances. If we leave, we all leave, and I shall go to Judge Rucker at once and complain that you refuse to open the box in the presence of the widow's counsel. I believe he would enjoin you from opening it at all, pending a hearing. Deegan picked up the box. Hold it, I told him. I stepped and closed the door and stepped back. Mr. Parker has covered most of the ground, but he didn't mention what we'll do if you try moving to another room. That's my department. I'll stand with my back against the door. I moved. Like this. I'm 3 inches taller than you and 15 pounds heavier in spite of your belly, and with the box you'll only have one hand. Of course you can try, and I promise not to hurt you. Much. He regarded me, not cordially, and breathed. This is a farce, Parker declared. He came and joined me with his back against the door. Now or never, go ahead and open it. If Goodwin leaps for you, I'll trip him. After all, I'm a member of the bar and an officer of the law. Deegan was a stubborn devil. Even then, he took another 20 seconds to consider the situation, after which he moved to the far end of the table, facing us at a distance of 12 feet, put the box down and lifted the lid. The taxman moved with him and was at his elbow. The raised lid obstructed our view, and the inside was not visible, except to him and the New York State Tax Commission. They stared at it a moment, then Deegan put a hand in. When he withdrew it, it held a bundle of lettuce 3 inches thick, fastened with rubber bands. He inspected it all over, put it on the table beside the box, inserted his hand again, and took out another bundle. And others. 8 of them altogether. He looked at us. By God, he said with a little shake in his voice. I'm glad you fellows stayed. Come and look. We accepted the invitation. The box was empty. The top bills on 5 of the bundles were C's, on 2 of them 50s, and on the other one a 20. They were used bills, held tight and compact by the rubber bands. They wouldn't run as healthy as new stuff, around 250 to the inch, but they were not hay. Quite a hoard, Parker said. No wonder you're glad we stayed. If I had been here alone, I would have been tempted myself. Deegan nodded, looking dazed. I'll be damned. We'll have to count it. Will you help me count it? We obliged him. I moved the chairs up and we sat, Deegan at the table end and Parker and I at either elbow, and started in. The taxman was right behind Deegan's shoulder, bending over to breathe down the back of his neck. It took a long while because Deegan wanted each bundle counted by all of us, which seemed reasonable, and one of the bundles of 50s had to be gone over 6 times to reach agreement. When we finished, each bundle was topped with a slip of paper with the amount and our initials on it. On another slip, Deegan listed the amounts and got a total. $327,640. If you don't believe it, I'll spell it out. 327,640 berries. Deegan looked at Parker. You expected this? No, I had no expectations whatever. He looked at me. Did you? I shook my head. Same here. I wonder what Wolf expected. You'd have to ask him. I would like to. Is he in his office? I looked at my wrist. He will be for another 15 minutes. Lunch at 1:30 on Friday. We might make it. He returned the bundles to the box, locked it, picked it up, and headed for the door, with the New York State Tax Commission practically stepping on his heels. Parker and I followed and waited outside while he went with an attendant and the taxman to have the box slid into its niche and locked in. And when he rejoined us, we mounted together to the street floor.
There the taxman parted from us. Except for interested glances from a couple of guards, we drew no attention inside, but the press was on the job. As we emerged to the sidewalk, a journalist blocked our path and said the public wanted to know what had been found in Malloy's box. And when we refused to spill it, he stayed right with us until we were in the taxi with the door shut. The Midtown traffic kept us from getting to the old brownstone before 1:30. But since, as far as I knew, Patrick A. Deegan was still a suspect, I took him in along with Parker. Herding them into the office, I crossed the hall to the dining room and shut the door. Wolf, in the big chair with arms at the far end of the table, had just started operating on an 8-inch ring of ham and sweetbreads mousse.
"You brought visitors," he accused me.
"Yes, sir, Parker and Deegan. I know you won't work with the feed bag on, but we found $250,000 in used currency in the safe deposit box, and Deegan wants to ask you if you knew it was there. Shall they wait?"
"Have they eaten?"
"No." Of course, that wouldn't do. The thought of a hungry human, even a hungry murder suspect, even a hungry woman in his house, is intolerable. So we had luncheon guests. They and I split the mousse that was waiting for me, and while we finished it, Fritz manufactured a celery and mushroom omelette. Wolf tells me there was a man in Marseille who made a better omelette than Fritz, but I don't believe it. The guests protested that the mousse was all they wanted, but I noticed that the omelette was cleaned up, though I admit Wolf took a portion just to taste. Leaving the dining room, I gave Wolf a sign, and letting Parker conduct Deegan to the office, he and I went to the kitchen, and I reported on the ceremonies of opening the box. He listened with a scowl, but not for me. He hates to stand up right after a meal, and he hates to sit down in the kitchen because the stools and chairs aren't fit to sit on, for him. When I was through, he demanded,
"How sure are you that the box contained nothing but the money?"
"Dead sure. My eyes were glued to him, and they're good eyes, not a chance."
"Confound it," he muttered.
"My God," I complained, "you're hard to satisfy. 327,000.
"But only that. It's suggestive, of course, but that's all. When a man is involved in a circumstance pressing enough to cause his murder, he must leave a relic of it somewhere. And I had hoped it was in that box. Very well. I want to sit down."
He marched to the office, and I followed. Parker had let Deegan have the red leather chair, and Deegan had lit a cigar, so Wolf's nose twitched as he got his bulk adjusted in his chair.
"You gentlemen doubtless have your engagements," he said, "so I apologize for keeping you so long. But I never discuss business at the table. Mr. Goodwin has told me what you found in that box. A substantial nest egg. You have a question for me, Mr. Deegan?"
"A couple," Deegan said, "but first I must thank you for the lunch. The best omelette I ever ate."
"I'll tell Mr. Brenner. It will please him." "And the question?"
"Well," he blew smoke straight at his host, "partly it's just plain curiosity. Were you expecting to find a large sum of money in the box?"
"No, I had no specific expectation. I was hoping to find something that would forward the job I'm on, as I told you yesterday, but I had no idea what it might be."
"Okay," Deegan gestured with the cigar. "I'm not a suspicious man, Mr. Wolf. Anyone who knows me will tell you that. But now I've got this responsibility. The thought would have occurred to anybody finding that fortune in that box. What if you knew it was there or thought it was? And now that it's been found, what if you are figuring that a sizable share of it will be used to pay you for this job you're doing?"
Wolf grunted. "Surely that's a question for me to ask, not answer." "What if I am?"
"Then you are."
"I haven't said so, but what if I am?"
"I don't know. I don't know what to say." Deegan took a puff and this time blew it at Parker.
Frankly, I'm sorry I agreed to this. I did it for a friend who has had a tough break, Selma Malloy, and I wish I hadn't. I'm on a spot. I know she's all for the job you're doing, trying to find grounds for a new trial for Peter Hayes, and I am too, personally. So you might think I'd be willing to commit the estate to pay for your services and expenses. But the hell of it is that she says she won't take the estate or any part of it. That didn't matter when there were no visible assets to speak of, but now it does. It will go to someone eventually. Relatives always turn up when there's a pile in it. And what will they say if I've paid you some of it? You see my problem. He took a puff.
I do indeed.
Wolf's lips were slightly twisted, one of his smiles.
But you asked the wrong question. Instead of asking, what if I am, you should have asked if I am. The answer is no. I shall not demand or accept, if offered, anything from that trove.
You won't? You mean that?
I do.
Then why didn't you say so?
I have said so.
Wolf's lips straightened. And now that I have answered your questions, I beg you to reciprocate. You knew Mr. Malloy for some years. Have you any knowledge of the source of that money? No, I was absolutely amazed when I saw it.
Please bear with me. I don't challenge you. I'm merely trying to stimulate you. You were intimate with him?
Intimate? I wouldn't say intimate. He was one of my friends, and I did a little business with him from time to time.
What kind of business?
I bought advice from him now and then. Deegan reached to break cigar ash into the tray. In connection with investments of my organization. He was an expert on certain areas of the real estate market.
But you didn't pay him enough to supply an appreciable fraction of that fortune in the box.
My God, no. On an average, maybe 2,000 or 3,000 a year.
Was that the main source of Malloy's income, supplying investment advice regarding real estate?
I couldn't say. It may have been, but he did some brokerage, and I think he did a little operating on his own. I never heard him say much about his affairs. He had a close mouth.
Wolf cocked his head. I appeal to you, Mr. Deegan. You had a problem, and I relieved you of it. Now I have one. I want to know where that money came from. Surely, in your long association with Mr. Malloy, both business and social, he must have said or done something that would furnish a hint of activities which netted him $750,000. Surely he did, and if it meant nothing to you at the time, it might now if you recall it. I ask you to make the effort. If, as you said, you wish me success in my efforts on behalf of Mrs. Malloy, I think my request is justified. Don't you agree?
Yes, I do. Deegan looked at his watch and arose. I'm late for an appointment. I'll put my mind on it and let you know if I remember anything. He turned and turned back. I know a few people who had dealings with Malloy. Do you want me to ask them?
Yes, indeed, I would appreciate it.
I suppose you'll ask Mrs. Malloy yourself.
Wolf said he would, and Deegan went. Returning to the office after seeing him out, I stopped at the sill because Parker was on his feet, set to go. He told me not to bother, but I like to be there when the gate of Wolf's castle opens to the world. So I got his coat from the rack and held it for him. In the office, Wolf was having a burst of energy. He had left his chair to get the ashtray Deegan had used and was on his way to the door of the bathroom in the corner to dump it. When he reappeared, I asked him, "Nothing from Saul or Fred or Ori?" He returned the tray to its place, sat, rang for beer, two short and one long, and roared at me,
"No!"
When a hippopotamus is peevish, it's a lot of peeve. I should have brought a bundle of C's for him to play with, and told him so.